Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Included. My guest tonight is Ruth Kassinger. She's an award-winning author of science and history books, and we're talking about her latest, Slime, How Algae Created Us, Plague Us, and Just Might Save Us. Ruth, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Now, this is a wide-ranging book. How did you get interested in algae?
Well, I was working on another book that was about glass conservatories, the history of glass conservatories to nurture plants, and I went looking for the most modern version that I could find, and that one turned out to be in El Paso, Texas, where an entrepreneur was growing algae in big plastic panels. And the idea was that he would take the mixture of water and algae out of the plastic panels, spin out the water, and break down the algae to release the oil that they have. Well, that was really pretty interesting, and so I started to look into algae and discovered that there were many, many more interesting aspects to it than I had originally thought.
And it's all in your book. And the great thing is there's a lot of field reporting from the field in this book. And I love science books like that, where you go and visit these different entrepreneurs. And the interesting thing, too, is there'll be places you went that end up folding, that ended up not succeeding. And you write about that, too. But let's start with the basics. I think when people hear algae, they think algae are plants, but they're not plants. What are they?
Well, they're not. They don't have an exact taxonomic place. They are, they're not plants, they're not animals, they're their own beings. They range in size from the microscopic algae that float invisibly in the ocean to macroscopic algae that we know as seaweeds.
It's amazing to think that all of that is the same stuff. And there's basically three different kinds, and I'll name them, and you can just fill in what they are. Cyanobacteria.
Yes, cyanobacteria are the simplest of the algae, and they were the first ones that evolved about 3.8 billion years ago. And they have very simple mechanisms on their interior. They have no little organs, but they photosynthesize. They take sunlight and turn carbon dioxide and water into sugars.
But that's not the same as microalgae, right?
Microalgae came actually several billion years later, and they are also single-celled, but they're much more complex. They have little organs inside that make a lot more proteins, and are much more efficient at taking sunlight and turning it into sugars and carbohydrates. They're a little bit bigger, but again, they're still invisible.
It seems like there's a huge leap between this blue-green algae or cyanobacteria, microalgae, and then the third group is seaweeds, which, like you mentioned, can be huge when you look at things like kelp and stuff like that. It seems like there should be some stuff in the middle.
Well, I guess you can say that there are some seaweeds that are quite small. But seaweeds really are agglomerations, permanent agglomerations, of these same single-celled microscopic algae. They just evolve to have different parts. And as you say, some of them can be 200 feet tall. Those are the giant kelp off of the coast of California. But there are still small, still small ones. But they came very late in the story of evolution, not until about 600 million years ago, which compared to the cyanobacteria, which are 3.8 billion years old, they're the new kids on the block.
It's amazing in the beginning of the book, you talk about the effects that these algae, especially these phytoplanktons, have had on the evolution of the Earth's sort of atmosphere. I mean, they literally made life possible on the planet.
Yes, we really owe our lives to algae. The cyanobacteria, when they turn carbon dioxide and water into sugars, emit a tiny bubble of, and after several billion years, there was enough oxygen emitted by these tiny creatures to create the oxygenated atmosphere. But in the meantime, before they emitted that much oxygen that it got into the air, the oxygen that they produced combined with iron that was dissolved in the oceans and turned all of that iron, which made our oceans look green, into iron ore. So they created 85 billion tons of iron ore. So those are just two of the early impacts that they had on the world.
You're right that 50% of the oxygen we breathe now is made by algae.
That's true. Some scientists say it's up to 70%. When you think about it, it's not that surprising because water covers 72% of the globe's surface. And water in the oceans, if you were to look at it in cross-section, the top 600 feet, which is called the photic layer, is filled with algae. Jeez. If you had a single drop of ocean water and you swallowed it, you would swallow several thousand algae. These creatures are so small, and there are so many. There are as many algae in our oceans as there are stars in the universe. So their little bubbles of oxygen provide half of what we breathe every day.
Now, there's actually one other kind of organism that involves algae that a lot of people are familiar with but may not realize that algae are involved in it, and that's lichen.
Yes. You know, I really didn't know anything about lichen when I started the book. And in fact, I was looking out my window and looking at an old cedar tree and kind of fretting about it because it was covered in lichen. And I thought, oh, that lichen must be killing my tree. And I called the arborist, and he came and looked, and he said, no, that's perfectly harmless. And when I looked into lichen, I realized that I was looking actually at algae. It's a lichen is a combination of algae and fungi, and they form a permanent indissoluble union. And you can see these often dusty green patches on trees.
You can see them in a lot of places, like gravestones.
Right.
I don't think there's any other thing on the face of the planet where it takes two completely different, it looks like animal kingdoms or kingdoms, and combines them into a separate creature like lichen.
Right. I agree. I don't believe there's anything else like it. I thought about how the human body has many more bacteria than it does have human cells. But still, even though there are 10 times more bacteria in our bodies than there are human cells, we're still human. But put
we're not part back. We're not like we haven't formed a union. They're along there for the ride. We're containing them. We're the container for the bacteria. This lichen thing is like a completely third organism
yes,
made by funky and algae, which is totally weird.
Yes, it is, and yet it's also extremely old. Lichen may have been the first green photosynthesizing organisms on the planet. They may have even preceded plants, which, by the way, are descended. All plants are descended from algae.
Now, there are some strange ideas, too. And some people believe that algae may have had a role in human evolution because of the iodine and the human brain development.
Yes, it's an interesting story. You know, you have to go back about several million years when our long ago ancestors were living in trees, and the climate changed at that time, and the forests in Africa dried out and became savannas, and the Great Rift Valley opened in Africa, which along the valley bottom created a lot of small lakes and ponds. And some of the creatures who lived in the trees, that was Homo erectus, came down and either settled around the lakes or came during the day to eat, because there's lots to eat in lakes and ponds. And those sea creatures, or freshwater creatures, ate algae. And algae is really dense with nutrients, including iodine. And the idea is that those creatures who ate a regular diet of seafood got more iodine from secondhand from the algae. And iodine is great for the brain and allows more thyroid to be made. And thyroid increases brain density. So we may owe our brains to algae.
We're owing algae a lot. the air we breathe.
We are.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Ruth Kassinger, award-winning author of science and history books, and we're talking about her latest, Slime, How Algae Created Us, Plague Us, and Just Might Save Us. And that brings up the idea of algae as food, and I think most people must realize that we eat seaweed in a lot of different forms. If you've eaten a lot of sushi, you've eaten nori, which is seafood. Miso soup has got seaweed in it. It's used as additives, as thickeners, as to add umami. But one of my favorite stories that you have in the book is this stuff called laver bread from whales.
Yes, it's a seaweed that's very closely related to nori. And the Welsh have been eating it in all kinds of dishes for hundreds of years, perhaps longer. And they call it laver bread. It's not anything like bread. It's called laver bread because in order to prepare it, people used to knead it to make it softer and more pliant. But several traditional Welsh dishes include this seaweed, and it's really quite tasty. I cook with it all the time now.
Can you just buy laver bread?
Well, you can buy laver in the grocery store. It comes dried.
Okay.
So it's pretty easy to find. It's, you know, in Costco and Walmart and all kinds of.
I want to mention that also at the back of the book you have a whole list of seaweed recipes.
Yes.
Which is really cool. They're really actually great recipes. Now, one of the foods you often hear about is spirulina, and it's advertised as doing everything, like a superfood, but is it really a superfood?
I don't think so. Spirulina is a cyanobacterium, so it's the simplest kind of algae, and it does have a lot of vitamin A in the form of beta carotene. So, you know, if you take six of these spirulina pills every day, you can get your daily dose of vitamin A, but you know, I don't believe that it is a superfood. It has a little iron. That's good. Now it is important in less developed countries where people don't have access to vitamin A. It can really make the difference between a normal sight for eyesight for a child and not, but in developed countries, you're probably just as well off eating a carrot once or twice a week.
Now, there are so many other ways that algae is used. It's used as animal feed. There is a product known as, let's see if I pronounce this correctly, carrageenan.
Yes.
And that's what, a thickener?
It is. It's, you know, algae, in order to survive in the wild and evolve, had to, way back, you know, over 3 billion years ago, come up with a covering that would protect their little cells from UV light. And they developed what's called a phycocolloid, which is a clear substance that covers the algae and makes them feel a little slimy. But we use that. We can take it out of the algae and use it as thickeners and emulsifiers, which help suspend solids and liquids. So if you have a glass of chocolate milk, the chocolate is probably suspended in the milk with carrageenan.
And it's also used, you can find seaweed in microbiology in the form of agar.
Yes. I don't think that modern medicine and biology would be the same without the algae. It's actually a seaweed called gelidium, from which we get agar in the bottom of petri dishes.
Wow.
That pinkish solid, mm-hmm. but translucent solid, is actually made from a seaweed, and it's been perfect for growing bacteria. And back in the 1800s, Robert Koch would probably not have developed the first understanding of how bacteria work if he hadn't been able to grow anthrax in agar.
Now, as your book progresses, as slime progresses, the subjects get more and more, I guess, important or critical, especially looking towards global climate change. You write a lot about people who are exploring using algae as fuel and developing algae oil. And that seems like it's going to be a really important, now there's just in the beginning stages, they're not really ready to use algae as fuel yet, are they?
No. This has been a continuing dream of biologists and entrepreneurs to make a fuel out of algae. The reason why it comes to mind is because all of the petroleum that we have is really dead algae compressed over the course of millions of years at the bottom of the ocean or underground. So the question naturally has arisen, which is, could we make fuel, oil, from algae growing today rather than taking it out from underground and burning it and putting sequestered carbon dioxide into the air? You know, the turning point came in about 2008. The price of oil was very high, and over 24 companies got into the algae oil business, growing algae in these enormous concrete ponds that were stirred by paddle wheels, and then trying to get either to take the oil out of the algae, because some algae store a lot of oil, or taking the whole biomass and compressing it with heat and pressure and turning it into oil. And they made very good progress. The Navy used algae oil to run an experimental fleet called the Great Green Fleet, which had ships and planes. But the problem has been that it's just too expensive. It can't compete at this point with fossil fuel. So although it's not ready for market, the technology is well advanced, and certain new developments like CRISPR and certain engineering techniques may make it possible in the coming years.
There are times, though, when algae seems to turn against us. And I want to talk about algae blooms. And I knew, obviously, that algae blooms existed. Reading your book, I didn't realize algae blooms are so widespread. And some of them have gotten so bad. Why do algae blooms occur?
Well, we can say that it's two factors. Probably the chief one is that we allow too much fertilizer to run off of our farms and make its way to streams or ponds and lakes and the ocean. And that's food for algae. They love that nitrogen and phosphorus, and they avidly eat it up and multiply like mad. And before you know it, you have an algae bloom. So that's the other cause is climate change. Algae like it hot, and we are warming up the air and now warming up the water, and so it's making conditions perfect for algae.
And for people who've never seen algae blooms before, it can be pretty gross.
It can be very gross.
I mean, you have some photographs in the book that are just, I mean, especially with a certain species of algae, it's this thick, slimy, green stuff, and it ends up killing all the life that's underneath it.
That's right. People have sometimes said that it looks like guacamole floating on the water. I mean, it can get really thick. And that blocks the light to other creatures that photosynthesize, like seagrass.
Right.
And, can kill organisms. And some of these algae, especially in large numbers, produce toxins. And when fish or seabirds or our pets or even us imbibe that water, we can get sick. And fish and sea animals definitely die.
Your book, again, proceeds from sort of the ancient world right up to the current world, and there really is an emphasis on just some of the problems involving algae and global climate change. And the story can get pretty grim. And as I was finishing your book, I was like, oh, God. But is there any hope? I mean, is there hope on the horizon that we can sort of start changing our ways and with algae's help?
Well, I think so. One thing that we can do is focus a little bit more on algae fuel. I ask people to remember that it was not that long ago when solar power companies were first starting, and we said, it's too expensive and it's improbable. We can never really use the solar power. But, with time and with investment and subsidies, it has paid off. And I think we can do something similar with algae fuel. If not for cars and trucks, then for jet fuel. Huh. Because there's no running an airliner on batteries. So even if we run our cars on electricity, we're not running our airplanes. And if the aviation industry was a country, it would be the seventh largest emitter of greenhouse gases.
That's
so
right.
It could be significant.
Also, it seems like the potential for algae is a widely used food to feed the ever-increasing population also seems to be something that's positive.
I think so. You can go, the great thing about algae is it doesn't take any fresh water to grow, and it doesn't take any farmland. So you can grow algae in the desert. You recycle most of the water, and algae, seaweed, for example, like nori, is 50% protein. And so using the protein of algae as a food supplement is very promising.
When you finished doing all the research for the book, were you surprised about how all-encompassing algae is in our life, that it seems to affect every aspect of our life, including in our evolutionary life?
Well, I was. I was. The more I researched, the more I thought, oh my goodness, I'm going to have to write, you know, 7 volumes. But I didn't. I did narrow it down to one pretty easy read. But, you know, you're right. The more you look, the more you see algae is everywhere.
It is an amazing book to read. I thought I knew some stuff about algae, and I knew very, very little. And the more I read, the more I feel like, God, I owe my existence to algae, at least in part. And so think about that the next time you look at a pond, green pond slime. It's like you owe that slime. My guest tonight is Ruth Kazinger, award-winning author of science and history books. And we've been talking about her latest. It's a great read. And it's just exciting to all the places you go and all the possibilities that we may that it offers us to deal with climate change. Slime, how algae created us, plague us, and just might save us. Ruth, it's been a real pleasure.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure for me.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. Good night.